This is One Pills Live, presented by Kaleida Health.
Welcome into hour number two of One Bills Live. I'm Maddie Glab, joined by Bills Wall of Famer Steve Tasker, filling in for Chris Brown for the day. We hope you guys are having a fantastic Thursday, even though it's a little bit gloomy outside. But in hour number two of the show, we are joined by Fox Rules analyst and former NFL Senior VP of Officiating, Dean Blandino, joining us right now. Dean, thanks for being on with us. We are just finishing up with league owners meetings, the spring meetings in Minnesota, and a lot of news came out of those meetings. We knew that one of the big things that was going to be talked about was the tush push. Now, the Packers resubmitted a proposal and kind of changed the language about the tush push. And the language said that offensive players cannot assist the runner except by individually blocking opponents for him. So this one more broadly banned pushing or pulling the ball carrier anywhere on the field. And as it was voted on, it received 22 votes to support this change and 10 votes to not support. Now, we know that you need 24 votes for something to be passed, so the tush push lives on. What did you know about the change in language from the Packers, and did you believe that the tush push would be banned for the 2025 season?
Well, yeah, I know. My feeling was, is I felt like, I didn't think it was a slam dunk, but I felt like there was going to be enough votes, the 24 votes, to get it out. And obviously that didn't happen. What the Packers did, the initial language, the initial proposal, really just focused on the tush push. And there was language in there about immediately pushing the ball carrier, those types of things. And that was when they took that vote back in March, kind of a straw poll. It was 16-16. And then they took a more holistic approach and said, okay, it's not just the tush push, it's all assisting the runner. They basically went back to the old language prior to 2006, when pushing the runner was basically allowed with rule language at that point. And obviously they went from 16 to 22, so six more teams were in favor of getting it out. But I know the Eagles presented, there were some compelling arguments on both sides. It got contentious. And, you know, I think we're right where we started. The tush push is going to be a play. And I wouldn't be surprised if game one, Eagles, Cowboys, the Eagles come out first play from scrimmage and they just run the tush push just to say, you know what? It's here. It's staying.
Oh, my
gosh. I agree. I thought they might do it just 25 times. Right. So, yeah. You've been in those meetings, and we heard, too, some stuff that we don't really hear about. Like, it was an executive closed, I can't remember exactly the word they used it, but it was only owners were in there. Jeff Lurie made an impassioned speech about how he thought it should be included. How do those meetings, obviously they did it because it was going to be contentious. How do those meetings usually work?
Yeah, so there's a general session where, you know, and I've been a part of those, where the competition committee is there, maybe representatives from the officiating department, the league office. And that's where the topic is discussed. Maybe we're looking at film and we're going through that. And I know the Eagles presented, they brought Jason Kelsey to discuss the play and his experience with it. They had a lot of video. And then at that point, there are these privileged sessions where it is just two representatives from each team, and typically that's ownership, and that's what they did when they took the vote, and I know Jeffrey Lurie, the Eagles owner, had kind of got up and made an impassioned speech and talked about a bunch of different things. And it was, from what I've been told, it did get contentious. And then ultimately the commissioner at that point is like, okay, we're going to vote. And you go around and you kind of, okay, alphabetical order, Arizona, Buffalo, and yay or nay. And then we tally it up and you see where you're at the end.
So they were close to this going through 22-10. You just needed two more teams to say, yes, we agree with the Packers proposal. We want this to go through. So knowing that it was that close, How do you believe officials will be looking at this play throughout the season? Are there going to be any extra eyes on how this plays out, either from a big picture perspective or from a game-to-game perspective throughout the season?
This play has been a challenge for officials. It really is, because, look, it's short yardage. Short yardage is hard to begin with because, you know, you've got a pile of players. You're trying to find the football. Where is it in relation to the first down or the goal line? So I don't think officials are going to change much what they do. I know they're going to officiate the line of scrimmage very closely. On the defensive side of the ball, if they're going to come up, we saw what happened in the NFC Championship game with Washington and trying to jump over the top.
Yep.
Are they going to devise some other tactics to try to stop this play or even like create a situation where you don't want to run this play because maybe it puts players at unnecessary risk? You know, the injury data, I know that was part of the conversation from the league office. Personally, I don't think player safety is always at the top when you talk about rules changes and the game. But I don't think this play, the data says it's any more dangerous than any other short yardage play. But we'll see. We'll see what comes out of it next year. And we might be right back here next year having the same conversation.
Give us an idea, if you can put it in layman's terms, what are we going to notice, if anything, about the onside kick rule that's been changed?
Yeah, this, and I haven't seen the language yet. Look, the issue is with the onside kick, it has become, and Steve, you know from playing special teams and being so good at it, the onside kick is, it's a hard play to execute with the old rules, right, where you had the run-up and you could overload, and it was still a 13-14% success rate. Now, with all of the changes we've made to the kickoff, we've eliminated the possibility of a surprise kick. That onside kick, that success rate is down less than 5%. And that's an important play in the game because, yes, the team that is in the lead earned that lead, and that's really important. But you don't want to have games that are out of reach, too many games out of reach, because that goes to the popularity of the game and television ratings and just the excitement. You want close games and exciting finishes. So the rule change is devised to give everybody a little more, move everybody up to the 35-yard line and maybe give them more of an opportunity, the kicking team, to get downfield faster, that 10 yards, cover that ground, and get more onside kicks recovered. So I think that's the genesis of the rule change. I haven't seen the language yet, but I know that's kind of the intent, is to try to help the kicking team recover more onside kicks.
We also know that Sony's Hawkeye cameras will be used to measure first downs in 2025, something that's been talked about over the last couple of years, and now we're going to finally see it being implemented. How do you think this will change the game, if at all?
Well, I think with this, the officials are still going to spot the football, and we're not there yet from a technology standpoint where that the Hawkeye system, the camera system can spot the football for the officials. So the officials will spot the ball, and what you won't see is the chains come out. You won't see the chain crew. It'll be a graphic that pops up on the video board in the stadium on your television screen that will show, and it'll be an animation that'll show where the ball is in relation to the first down, and either it's a first down or it's short, and it'll give that exact precise distance in terms of the relation to the first down. So I think that's what we're going to see. The chains will still be there as a backup, but this will be an electronic measuring system that should be more efficient than bringing the chains out.
Now, one that's really interesting to me is the replay review can look at more plays. Can you give us a rundown on what those might be and how we might notice it?
Sure. I think what replay, we've heard this term a lot last couple of years, replay assist. And this is not a replay review, but this is replay using the video to provide the officials with objective information. And they've expanded that to some areas like fouls. It's only when there's a flag on the ground, and that's really important. Replay can't come in and say, you missed a face mask, it's drop a flag on the ground. What they can do this year, in addition to if there's a flag for roughing the passer for a hit to the head neck area, and the contact is clearly at the shoulder or at the chest, replay can communicate that and pick the flag up. This year, areas like face mask, if the officials have a flag on the ground for a face mask, and replay sees that the player didn't grab the mask, the player actually grabbed the jersey or grabbed the shoulder pad, they can communicate that to the on-field crew and have that flag picked up. So it helps correct situations where there might be a penalty enforced incorrectly, but it won't be replay assisting to put flags down. They're not there yet, and that's always been – the competition committee has been kind of hesitant to do that in the past.
We hear, you know, ahead of every season, get a chance to talk to NFL officials about what the next season will look like in terms of what officials will be monitoring closely. What will officials be looking at with an extra eye and taking extra time to consider this season?
One of the things that was a real point of emphasis during the competition committee discussions and at the league meetings was sportsmanship. And I think there are many at the league office that feel like sportsmanship has somewhat taken a step back, and we're seeing more. Look, not the celebrations. The league has done a really good job in terms of, it used to be the no fun league. Now they allow more spontaneous stuff, the group stuff. That's all fine. But I think the league feels that there has been an uptick in whether it's in your face type stuff, whether it's mimicking a violent gesture or something that's could be in bad taste, sexually suggestive, that type of thing. So I think the league, and there's some stats out there that those types of actions are way up. And I know that is something the officials going into the season will be looking at more closely. So we will see more flags for unsportsmanlike conduct in those areas.
What are the statistics telling the league about the 35-yard touchback rule, where they're going to move the ball out an extra 5 yards and the touchbacks? What kind of stats are there that are going to say, yeah, you know what, we're expecting more returns this year than we have seen in the past?
No question that change is they want to see more returns. Going into the 2024 season, because it was such a significant change and they didn't know what the injury data was going to look like, they said, okay, let's keep the touchback at the 30. Because we don't want to go from, right, 2023 was the lowest in terms of kick returns ever. It was 22%. It wasn't even close. Prior to that, the fewest was 36%. So they didn't want to go from 22 to, say, 80 and have a whole bunch of injuries. So they kept the touchback if you just kick it through the end zone at the 30. Now the injury data was positive. That the dynamic kickoff, this play, at least it's a 1 year, so it's a small sample size, but for one season, that play does not have a higher rate of injury than other plays from scrimmage. So now they're going to move the ball to the 35. Again, that further decentivizes the kicking team from putting it through the end zone, because you may give up the 30 as field position, okay, because the average return was probably pretty close to the 30-yard line, but you're not going to give up the 35 consistently. And so this will mean more kicks in the field of play, more returns. And I think what they're expecting is probably somewhere closer to between 40 and 50% in terms of returns, which would be, you know, moving back toward where we were in the 80s and 90s before we had all these changes.
It'll be exciting to see more returns. I'm looking forward to it. Dean, thank you so much for taking the time to be on with us today, kind of break down some of these new rules we can expect to see in the NFL coming this season.
Thanks, Dean.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that was NFL rules analyst from Fox, Dean Blandino, joining the show. Also NFL senior VP of officiating, former NFL senior VP of officiating. Good insight there on some things that they'll be following more closely. We all know that even if it's not going to be effective as a rule yet, officials always go into the season with, hey, these are things we want to monitor. These are things that we think have become more and more increasingly a part of the game, and it's mm-hmm. good or it's bad. So this is why we are going to be watching.
Are you
that.
Surprised at the sportsmanship thing? I kind of am.
Yeah.
I'll say this. It doesn't surprise me. I didn't notice it too much watching the games mm-hmm. that some people thought there was more in-your-face kind of stuff and taunting. It doesn't surprise me that the league would take steps towards. I know he's right. It used to be the no fun league. Now you can celebrate with your yep. teammates and do all that other stuff, the fun stuff. But they do. It's indicative of how the league curates what goes on the field. They don't really just legislate. They curate it. They're trying to make it something, you know, attractive in every respect, and they think about stuff like that. I think some people might be surprised by that. I don't think I am. they like the, yeah, they look at everything.
Mm-hmm. Sportsmanship, I remember seeing some things last year, and I was like, this is a little interesting. I wonder, no call here.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see what they think about it in the following year. So we'll see, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see, yeah. He said, Dean Blandino said he expects more personal fouls because of sportsmanship this year. They're going to, like, crack down on, which is, okay.
An extended replay is also going to be nice on some plays where you can pick up the flag if
if it's a bad call, they'll pick it up.
If it's a bad call, if it wasn't an obvious hit to the head, if it was more on the shoulder, I think that's something that everybody has been looking for. Not saying that officials get it wrong on every play, but sometimes it's hard to spot something like that.
Right.
And to have to be able to look at it more closely and deem yes or no, I think is going to be good.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the officials will still throw the flag, but if they get it wrong, there are more plays where the eye in the sky, the sky judge will just say, no, that was you missed that, pick it up.
Yep.
And they'll just pick it up. They'll never, well, I don't say never. The eye in the sky still cannot throw a flag. Like, say, hey, you missed a
the
face
flag
mask.
Drops down from the sky. I'm just kidding.
You can't make that. They're not going to do that, and for obvious reasons. So, they continue to try and get it better and better and better, and they're honing in on it. And I think it's fun to think about the kickoffs getting, maybe 40% or 50% kickoff returns. That'd be nice. Because that has to do with roster makeup as well. You need guys who can do it and do it well. You can't just throw 10 guys out there with a kicker and know that it's going to go through the end zone. You don't have to cover it. You got to put some guys out there who know what they're doing. So that will make a difference for some teams.
It's Paul Hamilton.
That's what they called me in college, it's the bone.
He has the facts to back up his opinions.
People ask me, well, how are the Sabres are they going to win tonight? I don't have a clue.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
It's been a minute since we talked to the mighty Paul Hamilton on the Wester Hotline, or really any hotline for that matter. But here, of course, it is always the Wester Hotline. Glad to have you with us here on a Monday. And Paul Hamilton joins me now live on said Wester Hotline. Paul, what's shaking, man? How are you?
Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley, and Dean Memminger.
Paul, are you on another line talking to someone? Like, what?
Well, I just heard in the sports that the last time the New York Knicks won the championship was 1973.
Okay, good job. Yeah, good. I was 8. All right. Yeah. Good deal. All right.
Guys like Walt Frazier and Willis Reed.
Yeah. Been a minute. And,
Dave DeBuscher.
Yeah. No, I remember all of them. I mean, I can't give you a chapter and verse on them all, but
playing against Jerry West.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thanks. Do you hate Mitch Marner?
I don't like the idea. He might be a very nice person. He's a very good offensive hockey player, but he's not what the Buffalo Sabres need. I mean, the Buffalo Sabres were 10th in the league in scoring at 3.23 goals per game. If you got up to 3.26 goals per game, they're 7th in the league in scoring. I mean,
Mitch Marner can do that for him, Paul.
What the problem with the Buffalo Sabres is they're 29th in the league in defense, and they have goaltenders that can't make a big save at a big time for them, and they need players that can jump into your top six. I have a better idea than Mitch Marner. How about Sam Bennett or Marchand, who have won cups, who can play in your top six, who can play offensively and defensively, can upset the other team? They will get the other team upset instead of the Sabres having to react. Other teams will have to react to the Sabres. That's the types of players that they need, and they're winners. You know, they're winners. They can play both ends of the ice. They're tough to play against. They score goals in big games. You know, they're leaders. I mean, and people, well, they're not coming to Buffalo. Well, is Mitch Marner coming to Buffalo?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, this entire conversation requires a certain level of suspension of disbelief. That like maybe the gyrations aren't even worth the time. But you know, whatever. Here's the thing about I don't disagree with you about Bennett or Marchand even at this stage. The thing is, I think everyone agrees. Marner is, you know, Paul. I'm trying to get through a day here. Marner. Marner, like, people are, I think, going to overreact to Marner. A part of my thinking is a player that looks flawed in one place, and I recognize Toronto is not Buffalo, okay? So it's not exactly apples and apples. But you've seen guys who acquired reputations for sulking and not being able to pull it together, even though they had a very talented roster and all these different things. They go elsewhere and they fly and they're free. I'm not predicting for sure that will happen with Mitch Marner, but to me, getting out from under Toronto and all the expectations could be extremely good for him. And as far as his, you know, one-sided type player, he was a Selke Trophy finalist 2 years ago. And he plays on the penalty kill. This is not just a one-dimensional player entirely.
I disagree. I think he is a one-dimensional player. I think he makes them worse defensively, not better. They'll probably be 30th or whatever defensively. Especially watching him in the playoffs, some of the things he's done defensively in the playoffs, I'm shaking my head. What are you doing? What I mean, you're just wandering around. You're not even paying attention. You know, I've said that out loud as I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what in the world are you doing? And so, to me, you know, I don't care if he was a Selke Trophy candidate or whatever.
It's not whatever. I mean, it's the best defensive forward in hockey. Now, he didn't win it, but to be nominated, was everybody sniffing glue that year? I mean, I don't understand why.
Nominated by what? The Canadian media? Or, you know, I just
– okay.
I'm not on board with it. I'm
all
just
right.
not.
All right.
And I think they become a worse defensive team on a team that has to be better defensively. All right, so he shows up, and instead of being 10th in the league in scoring, you're 7th in the league in scoring or 6th in the league in scoring. Great. Now what? I still don't have a goalie that can make a save. I still don't have a team that plays well defensively. And I've just sunk $12, $13 million into that.
Oh, keep going. 14, 50, whatever. Yeah. Whatever the max is what it would cost anyway.
Paul, can I interest you in a bunch of six-five
wins? That's what I'm after, right?
Yeah. I would rather go with the established winning players that can also score goals, maybe can't get 100 points, but allows me to put Zach Benson in Rochester and put a very decent hockey player into my top six that is going to be good offensively and good defensively and can score the big goal at the big time and have been winners and are abrasive to play against. And I would just rather have that player. I think that's the player the Sabres need a lot more than just,
yep.
And I'm just going to say it, a one-dimensional offensive type guy.
Well, I love that you have chosen to not respect the Selke Trophy finalist thing, because it certainly helps your argument and hurts mine. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I the fact that he plays on the penalty kill and was nominated for that, to me, flies in the face of the reputation.
They don't have anybody else to play in the penalty kill. They got all offensive forwards.
Are you kidding me? Pontus Holmberg can't kill penalties?
Well, yeah.
Jan Kruk or whoever these people are? What are you talking about?
They did change it around this year. They were better defensively this year as a team. That game against Buffalo here in Buffalo, did the Sabres even have a scoring chance all night? I mean, they just shut it down and got great goaltending. So, yeah, they were better defensively this year, definitely. But at the end of the day, when they needed to be good defensively – in a game seven, they certainly weren't.
Holy cow. Paul, yeah, we can table the, you know, the Marner thing is going to be there. That is going to be evergreen until July 1st when he signs, you know, with Tampa or whatever's going to happen, wherever he ends up going. Really, though, one last thing. The point to me is, the way I phrased it to begin with, like if, because I don't think any of these people are going to be interested in signing with the Buffalo Sabres, like the top, any of the names you mentioned here, Bennett and Marchand, who, again, I'll say it again just in case anyone didn't catch it. I'm sure you did. I agree with you. That style of player is certainly in line with what I need. I'm just saying, if Marner actually wanted to talk to me, I'm not hanging up the phone. Like, I'm not going to feel too proud to take that call and consider signing him, despite him not being the best fit, because I need to do something to change the narrative around this team. And he's, you know, someone that I think could certainly do that. Anyway, Paul, games 5 and 7 in Toronto. Have you, Mike said it great after game 5 on Wednesday, Thursday, and here he said, it's got to be the worst sporting event you've ever attended if you were there. And I mean, and I would agree. And then maybe last night only trumps it because you got the game 6 to give you hope again. And then here comes game 7. And it's really, I've never seen a team after the handshakes when a series is over gather at center ice to salute the fans and get booed. I mean, that was brutal. I'm not saying they didn't deserve it. I mean, those two games, Paul, I just can't even explain it.
And the thing about it is, it's not just this year. I mean, it keeps happening over and over and over and over again. And it's so that's, I think, what makes it even worse, that you've got guys that perform very well in the regular. I mean, Austin Matthews is one of the best goal scorers in the National Hockey League in the regular season. And then he gets to the playoffs, and where is he? We need a goal. It's game 5. It's game 7. Where is he? Where are all these guys? Mm-hmm. You know, that are very, very good in the regular season. And as we said, they were a better defensive team this year. Thinking, okay, we've made ourselves better defensively. We have a goaltender that's playing very, very well for us. Unfortunately, that goaltender got hurt, but Wolk wound up with a shutout along the way, and I don't think he was as good as Stolarz was, but I'm not sure Stolarz would have changed this around. We don't know. We'll never know. But that's the thing. I think that's what makes it worse, is it just keeps happening over and over and over again. And if you're the Toronto Maple Leafs trying to figure out what are you going to do, what makes you think sticking with it is going to make a change all of a sudden?
So what do you think moving forward here? Not for the Leafs entirely. I mean, I think their decisions will be largely made for them by guys hitting the market, though I guess maybe Tavares might want to stay, and they'll have a choice to make there if they want to keep going down that road. Really will depend on whether they can attract one of the players you've mentioned here, because Sam Bennett seems like a perfect ready-made replacement for Tavares on the free agent market. Should he get to the market, we'll see how that all shakes out. But we've got Florida and Carolina in the East, Dallas and Edmonton in the West. Three of the four from last year. Only the Rangers were in the Carolina spot last year. What do you think of the field left?
It's interesting that in the NHL, the overall placement of these teams, you got Team 5 in Dallas, Team 9 in Edmonton, Team 10 in Carolina, and Team 11 in Florida. And even in the NBA, you do have Team 1 in Oklahoma City. But then you got to go down to Team 5 with the Knicks, Team 6 with Indiana, and Team 10 with Minnesota. So in both leagues, the higher seeds for the most part, other than in Oklahoma City, yep, and in Dallas, if you want it, it just goes to show you, you know, and Tampa did the same thing. Tampa didn't care if they won the division. They didn't care if they won the President's Trophy or any of that kind of stuff. It's like, let's get ready for the playoffs. That's what the regular season. For those teams, it's an 82-game preseason. It's like, let's make sure we get in the playoffs, but we don't care where we get in. Let's just play, you know? And Florida's 11th. Are they the 11th best team in the National Hockey League? No. But that's the way mm-hmm. they hung out, and that's what Tampa did for those years, too. They just hung out, made the playoffs. They didn't care. It doesn't really matter if you're home ice or not. I mean, the road team wins quite a bit in the playoffs, and I think that's what we're seeing now is teams, you know, good teams are just like, yeah, that's nice to win the President's Trophy. Congratulations. We don't care. We want to hang the big banner up there, and we're going to get ready to play for that big banner. And I think that's what we're seeing now. As far as Carolina, I feel like Jacques Lemaire has re-entered the league. I probably would rather do chores in the backyard than watch Carolina play.
I hated every minute of that Washington-Carolina series that I watched. I even would say, like, Owen would be in the kitchen, you know, grabbing something to drink or whatever. I'd be like, I hate watching these teams play. This is terrible.
And I understand, and people are right. Well, they win.
Yeah,
won the cup yet, but they're in the top four.
Yeah,
so it's working for them to play this way. It worked for the New Jersey Devils as Jacques Lemaire systematically ruined the National Hockey League by winning a couple of Stanley Cups that way, and then making other teams think, well, we got to play that way. No, we don't have to play that way. Why don't we just play some hockey that we actually can enjoy instead of playing that way? And Carolina plays that way, and if they happen to win the Stanley Cup, then all of a sudden, here we go. We're going right back to Jacques Lemaire and the Devils. Fire Lindy Ruff and get Jacques Lemaire in here and hire Lou Lamoriello, and here we go. And, you know, it's just I just do not enjoy watching Carolina play at all.
Paul, that's coming across. Paul Hamilton on the West Hur Hotline here for a few more minutes. How do you feel about the Amherst at this point, Paul? 1-1, and what are we, Wednesday, Friday again?
Yeah, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, if necessary.
All in Laval. Yeah.
I know fans are going to say stop making excuses for them, but – watching game one, I got just what I expected. The Amherst hadn't played in 13 days. You know, Levi's leaving rebounds out in the slot, and they're not good defensively. It's a 5-4 game. It's just not Amherst hockey. I mean, they just had to get themselves back into playoff form and back going again. And by game two, it was back. They played very well, even in the first period. They limited opportunities for Laval, played very, very well. I mean, Laval had 7 shots in the first period. I think 3 of them came in the last 30 seconds. I think they had 4 before that. By the end of the day, Levi only had to look at 19 shots. Even though he gave up 3, there were tips and things like that. I don't think really you would have blamed him on any of the goals. He played well. He was back to being what we had seen him throughout the season, and the Amherst were back playing the way they're very capable. And let's face it, I mean, Laval had the best record in the American Hockey League. You're not going to win 3 straight games there. They had to win that game at home, game 2, and they did a great job. You watch the 4 goals that they scored, all guys going to the net, multiple guys at the net, guys like Isak Rosén. I mean, he's on the wall. He wins 3 battles going to the net and then just keeps the puck alive in the crease. He just sticks his stick in there and keeps it alive so Rusick can tap it into the net. And there's Rusick at the net too. And it's just like that's what you want to see. What is Rosanna, about 175 pounds soaking wet? But, he's up against a 200-pound guy winning battles all the way to the net, and that's the way they scored their goals, and that's the way they play. Mike Leone has that team playing very, very well. And it'll be now. It just becomes a best 2 out of 3. Unfortunately for the Amherst, all 3. Well, maybe not. Unfortunately, because the Amherst are one of the better road teams in the American Hockey League, so they're comfortable playing on the road. So maybe it's not that big of a deal for them to have to go there and win 2 out of 3 games.
How much like Laval, the season series? We had Kevin Aklubjian on Friday, Paul, and he mentioned how the season series had been very heavily in favor of Laval. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, and I think I brought this up with you last week when we started to have an idea about what the field looked like and who they might be matching up with here, whether physically they would be able to handle it. And is there somewhat of a mismatch there between these two teams, or is it not that pronounced?
No, they're a bigger team, and they're not as goony and rough and tough as Syracuse is. That was a good start for Rochester to play them, because it's just a goon squad. I mean, it looks you think like you're watching some version of Slapshot watching them, and the Amherst stood up. The Amherst basically said, go ahead, you guys hit us in the back of the head and take us head first into the wall. We'll score on the power play, and we'll beat you in 3 games, and you guys can then go home. And that's basically what happened. Syracuse didn't stop playing like that. Rochester couldn't have cared less. And they played their game, and they won in three games. And that's what I saw in game two there and game one. They didn't back down in game one. But game two also, it's not – Laval isn't – they're big, and they'll slap you around a little bit, but they're not like Syracuse. And, you know, the Amherst are fine with it. They stood up to it. As I said, you know, they're right in there with the scrums. They're not backing down to anything. They're at the net, which got them four goals and then an empty netter because they're at the net. They don't care if you get cross-checked or whatever. It's like, fine, you do what you have to do. We'll do what we have to do, and we'll let our skill take over.
Did you enjoy the Subway Series, Paul?
Yes. I actually was taping the game yesterday so I could watch it after the hockey game. So I didn't know that Bellinger had hit a grand slam to like 1:30 in the morning when I was sitting there watching it. So it was, yeah, that was fun to see. That would be a great World Series.
What impressive. You avoided the result of your favorite baseball team's game until, what, 11:30 at night? That's incredible.
Well, I just stay off Twitter. I don't need to be on Twitter as I'm watching a hockey game. So.
But what about all my witty observations, Paul?
Well, I catch up eventually, but I got to be done with the baseball game before I can start catching up. You know, I do that. I do that sometimes with Bills games. You know, I've actually been on the road when a Bills game has started, and basically have been able to avoid the result till I get home that night and can watch the game and have no idea what happened in the game. It's not easy to do, especially with our guys around you that are interested in the game.
Right.
But I have pulled that off before to be able to do that. And sometimes I hate commercials. So sometimes on a Sunday, like a road game starts at 1 o'clock, I'll go shopping, go get groceries or whatever. And then, you know, I'm DVR in the game. And when I get home about, I don't know, 2:15, 2:30, I kick off. And then I can fast forward through commercials and everything. And basically, by the time I'm done, I finish the game around the same time everybody else does. But, you know,
Listen to this guy.
Well, you know, Twitter is not my favorite thing in the world. So staying off Twitter is not a hard thing for me to do. So especially on a football game like that, stay off Twitter. And just
I am like you on Bills game days for sure. Like the game starts and I try not to be there because, you know, everything is the worst thing that's ever happened. You know, as soon as there's a three and out or whatever. And I just, that overreaction, I don't need that in my brain space, generally speaking. So I try to avoid that while the game is on, obviously.
And, you know, with Bills fans, the Bills have never committed a penalty in the history of the franchise. And you know, that's fine. But to me, the refereeing is just horrendous in the NHL. It's in the NFL. And it's horrendous for everybody. I mean, I can sit there and pick out, you know, a lot of penalties that the Bills should have gotten or a lot of penalties that the Sabres should have gotten and a lot of penalties that didn't go their way, too. It's just – it's horrendous refereeing.
Well,
so I don't need to read about how the Bills got screwed by the referees and all that. No, everybody gets screwed by the referees, not just the Bills. Yeah, the Bills did.
Equal
and
opportunity
so did everybody
screwers.
Else.
Yeah, right. Well, I wanted to just squeeze in real quick, Paul, that I did not appreciate the Yankee fans being so rude to Juan Soto. So I'm sure you love that, but I didn't feel like that was very polite.
I think he was genuinely surprised.
That they treated him that way?
That game, by that ESPN game, he was basically just standing out there like a deer in headlights. You know how he likes to have fun and interact, and he did that in the first game, and it wasn't working. And he started, like, going out at the last possible second to take his place in the outfield. He'd stay in the dugout. Everybody else is out there warming up, and he's still in the dugout. And just out there, he did not look like he enjoyed it at all out there. And I think he was rather surprised. He got the greeting. I don't know why. I think he was in New York long enough to know how fans react to things out
there. Yeah.
But he, to me, maybe I'm wrong, but just looking at him, he seemed genuinely surprised he was being treated that way.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot for this. I'm sure we'll catch up later in the week with the Amherst playing on Wednesday and on Friday. Be well, buddy.
Thanks. Take care.
That's our Paul Hamilton on the West Her Hotline and his appearances here on WGR, brought to you by Equitable Advisors. Planning for your future is about more than just money. Let Equitable be your guide, and by Relax Honda. Relax, we got this.
It's Mike Shope.
Hey.
Put a little. I never get this line out the first time. It's not even good. Hey, put a little. Put a little bit more in there, cowboy.
And the bulldog.
What's your degree in?
Kicking ass and taking names.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
George Wendt has died. Reports. I suppose his role in Fletch would not be the first mentioned in his obituary. It'd be Norm. Cheers.
I think that's, yeah.
Fat Sam. Yeah. Fletch has lost two legends in a week. Joe Don Baker and George Wendt.
Oh, I didn't know the Whammer had ties to Fletch.
Oh, he's the mean cop. He kind of always was a mean somebody. Joe Don Baker in all his movies.
Yeah.
He had an edge to him. Also a man who has an edge to him, Warren Sharp, joining us now on the West Her Hotline, sharpfootballanalysis.com. One of the best in the business. Warren, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. So let's start with the schedule. I know you put a lot of time in trying to find disparities in team schedule and, you know, give a deeper insight into who really has weaker versus stronger schedules. How did the Bills come out here for you? I know I've seen a lot. They're on the weaker side of things. Maybe you can add to that with what you've researched.
Yeah, so if we were talking about just who they play, the Bills have the fifth easiest schedule in the NFL because they're playing some weaker divisions. I love the tentpole nature of the way that their games are spread out, the way that the schedule makers gave them three home games against the three toughest teams. Now, they didn't give them the home games. Those were already there, but they have the Ravens to start the season, the Eagles to end the season, the Chiefs smack dab right there in the middle of the season, as long as they don't blow a look-ahead spot off of a bye in Carolina against the Panthers week 8. Sets them up nicely against the Kansas City Chiefs in week 9. From a rest perspective, though, the Buffalo Bills do have some challenges from week 10 through 18. So immediately following the Bills, they play 4 games at a rest disadvantage and just 1 game at a rest advantage. And last year they went 11-2 when they had at or even rest compared to their opponent, but they were just 3-3 when they had less rest than their opponent. The Bills will play 4 of those games down the stretch of this season. It's the third worst rest differential to close out the season of any team in the NFL. I don't love the rest spots for them. The good news is the game after the bye week is the Carolina Panthers. I just told you about that one. That's a key one. You can't look ahead to the Chiefs. That's going to be a big thing. And many teams have struggled coming off of byes. Since that 2011 CBA, it used to be a great thing to have a bye because you could keep the players in town sometimes. You didn't have to give them the mandatory time off, but now they do. And the data certainly shows that teams are playing worse off of a bye. You know who the best team in the NFL is off of a bye?
It's been
the Buffalo Bills are 10-0 off of a bye. You guys are 10-0 off of a bye the last 10 years. You are the best team off of a bye in the NFL. Most teams have fallen back. You guys are surging ahead, whether you're talking against the spread where you're covering 75% or just outright winning these games. You're doing a tremendous job there as well.
Andy Reid is, I almost spat that out before your answer. Good thing nobody heard me because he has kind of the reputation here.
Definitely don't bring it up now.
Yeah.
No. So, Warren, if I may follow up, I'd like to hear you talk about, like, what is the extent of the advantage? Like, what does the data show I'm gaining or losing in these spots where I'm playing somebody, you know, that's had more rest? And I think, I know what you would say, I've read it from you, I agree with you, that the league should do a better job than it does at this. I mean, we know what their overall purpose is with the schedule, you know, eyeballs, but we both think they should do a better job at this, but there's only so far it can go. I think you'd agree. One of those Bills losses last year is the AFC Championship game, where Kansas City plays on early Saturday and they don't travel, and the Bills play Sunday night and do. So I think we'd all have to acknowledge that there are limits to what can be, you know, made better.
Yes, absolutely. Look, the NFL by nature is the least equitable sport that exists for a regular season schedule based upon who you play, because they're never going to balance it with the way that they have divisions and the way that they have other divisions that they rotate, and that's predetermined years in advance. The teams with the easiest schedule and the hardest schedule are much wider apart in the NFL than they are in baseball, where there's, 162 games, or basketball, where there's 82 games. There's so much more opportunity for those teams to have a more even schedule. So we know football, just based upon who you're going to play, before the schedule makers even get involved, is going to be less equitable. The goal, in my opinion at least, should be to try to ensure that that equity doesn't cross this imaginary line as they're trying to increase the revenue. But who's policing that? It's the league internally saying, this is, we're aware of that. It's not our primary focus. We're just trying to make sure that nobody's too out of bounds here with these equalities. Well, then you look at a team like the Cincinnati Bengals, who are playing in Baltimore on a Thursday night game for three straight years. Baltimore has played once on Thursday night in Cincinnati in the last 20 years. And why are they, Cincinnati, being forced to play in Baltimore three straight years? Why is the only, I know this doesn't involve Buffalo, but why is Dallas the only team this year that's playing three games in a 10-day span? You know, the NFL didn't have any teams playing three games in 10 days for years. Then they introduced it last year with the game on Christmas on a Wednesday, and all of a sudden now they still have it in the schedule this year. Nobody should have to play that. Why should one team have to play that? So, you know, if you're looking up and down the schedule, there are things that are inequitable that could be improved upon. Now, to your first question, what is the extent of the damage? What's the collateral damage here? Which are the worst spots that we should be focusing in on? Well, teams off of a short week road game. The reason I look at point spreads a lot of the time here is because point spreads should be the equalizer, right? Win-loss record is going to vary, but the point spread is supposed to try to generally get teams to hit right around 50% if the odds makers and the bettors are accurate with a very efficient market here. Teams on a short week road game, that means they're playing on a Sunday, now they have to go on the road on a Thursday, for instance. That's one time. Mm-hmm. Those teams have covered the spread at just a 48.3% clip. You might say that that's over the last decade. You might say that's close to a coin flip. That's okay. That's minus 7.8% ROI. If you're thinking about like your investment portfolios, 7.8% losing that is a pretty bad thing to be losing. And that's what happens when you're betting on teams that are playing a short week road game. Teams that play the following week after playing on the road on a Sunday or Monday night game, those teams are only covering the spread less than 49% of the time. Teams in the three games in 10 days, those teams are playing terribly. And why should you have, so those are spots that you should look out for, but the NFL doesn't really care too much about balancing those spots. So as a sports bettor, you could look to take advantage of those from a betting perspective, but from an equity standpoint, you should try to balance that out a little bit more. Why does, for example, I'll give you the most extreme example. Mm-hmm. Why do the Detroit Lions play eight games where they have a rest advantage, only one where they have a rest disadvantage, versus the Las Vegas Raiders play six games at a rest disadvantage, only one game with a rest advantage? No team in NFL history has played eight games with a rest advantage, but that's what the Lions get to play this year. No team in NFL history has played five teams coming off of a Monday night game on short weeks, but that's what the Detroit Lions get to play this year, as they face five such opponents. And as you guys know, it's very different if you're coming off Detroit. If you're Detroit playing a 1 p.m. game, you have all afternoon on Sunday to rest up all night, study the film, rest up, rehab all day Monday, and then watch the team that you're about to play play Monday night, get home to their houses on Tuesday morning, and be behind in catch-up. And they get to do that, play five games like that this year. So the NFL needs to do a little bit better job of trying to balance some of these things out, in my opinion.
Warren, one of the portions of the Bills schedule that concerns me the most, I like the schedule a lot. No Europe, no holiday stuff. So, you know, they got their allotment of primetime games, but they are playing. You got to it, look, talking about week 10, but even pulling back from there by a few weeks, beginning with week 6 in Atlanta, they play 7 of 10 on the road, 4 out of 5 in one pocket in the middle of that, and there's in the middle of, within that then, is a Thursday on the road in Houston off of, at least they're at home the week before, but how much does travel enter into the rest point you're making?
So travel, I do believe that teams have improved with the way that they travel, with their sports medicine and the way that they rehab, such that it makes travel not as big of a deficit. And something we looked out for a little bit more earlier on, not as much so now. Some teams prefer to have back-to-back games at times on the road, especially if they're like a West Coast team going east and they'll just stay over, and they feel like that knocks out some of those games. It reduces their overall travel, and then they get to play more home games stacked up at other points in the season. So it sort of really depends. You know, you're right. The Bills do have an interesting quirk where they're playing on the road in Atlanta, then a bye week, then on the road in Carolina. So they bookend their bye with a couple of road games. They do have back-to-back road games there where they're on Thursday Night Football in Houston, which is definitely a disadvantage. Playing that short week road game is a tricky spot for them after hosting the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So, you know, the other thing that they don't get the advantage of is playing or hosting any cold weather teams late in the season. You know, the teams that they're hosting late in the season are the Philadelphia Eagles, the New York Jets, and the Cincinnati Bengals. Those are the only home games that they play week 12 onward. Those three teams are obviously acclimated to playing in cold weather, so they're not gaining anything from that either.
Warren Sharp is our guest on WGR, Mike Shope and the Bulldog here. So the Bills have about, I mean, depending on what you like, division odds, win the conference championship, win the Super Bowl, the Bills again are at the top of the list. I think their odds of winning their division are the shortest of anybody. And, you know, of course, that's a reflection of what people think the rest of the AFC East will look like. What is your read on that? I think it's easy here to get comfortable. Miami has just not been able to take them down. New England and the Jets are closer to rebuilding teams. Is that how you see it, or is there maybe a trap here?
I don't think there's a trap from a division perspective. I think the Bills are as positioned, as you mentioned, the odds reflect this, as any team in the NFL at capturing their division crown. The key for the Bills, in my opinion, we know how important trying to host games in Buffalo is. It's not the end-all, be-all when it comes to, you know, going to the Super Bowl, but you definitely want to try to get that first round bye, especially when you have an early bye in week 7. And so, like, I'm not betting Bills minus 230 to win the AFC East, but I absolutely believe that the Buffalo Bills are going to win the AFC East. I think Justin Fields is not going to really elevate the New York Jets that much in 2025. I love what the Patriots did in the draft, and I think that they're on their way, but I don't know that year one with Mike Vrabel, they take that massive step to actually dethrone the Buffalo Bills. And then I think the Miami Dolphins are a team that's searching for answers and don't really have very many. So I think they're very much so up in the air. So I think the Buffalo Bills, what their biggest focus needs to be, if I'm being completely transparent, and if I was there helping strategize a game plan every week, it is, we need to figure out a way to get up on these teams that are worse than us. Most of the games that they're going to be playing are teams that are worse than them. Get up on these teams quickly in games, have leads early, build on those leads so that we can potentially rest some of our guys in that fourth quarter and not play in a lot of these one-score games, because we have an early week 7 bye, and we need to make sure that we have a bye the first week of the playoffs and can have home field advantage. So their goals, obviously their big picture goal, is to get that number one seed in the AFC. But in order to do that, it's think smaller, build leads in games, rest your guys because we have an early bye. In case something goes sideways and we don't get that bye first week of the playoffs, we have the opportunity to still have a healthy roster, because we know that you guys, particularly on the defensive side of the ball, have had your fair share of too many injuries, and you guys need to stay as healthy as possible. And the only way to ensure it, you can't ensure it, but the way to reduce it is to reduce the total number of snaps that your guys, that your starters have to play.
But that really came home to roost year before last when the Bills had to go right down to the wire the Sunday night game. They needed to win. They started that day not knowing if they were even going to be in the playoffs. It turned out win, and they won the division. But they had to go hard there and then play a wild card game. And the injuries they suffered in that Week 18 win in Miami, coupled with the injuries they suffered in the Pittsburgh wild card win, all but just crushed them for, I mean, they pulled A.J. Klein out of an RV driving his family to a vacation to come play linebacker, and he's chasing Travis Kelce around the field in a divisional round game. I mean, it was tough. The rest is so key.
I'll just say this. NFL teams, they're so focused on their goal each week is to be up when the clock hits zero after 60 minutes are done. They need to focus more on trying to be up by 10 points at the start of the fourth quarter. Yeah. They need to set goals to allow themselves to manage their team down the stretch of the fourth quarter to stay as healthy as possible and notch as many victories along the way as possible. Because, as you guys know, you get a tipped pass interception. Things can go sideways late in these games if you allow them to stay close. Your schedule, you are very fortunate this year. You play the fifth easiest schedule in the NFL. You play the number one easiest schedule of games at home in Buffalo of any team that plays at home. You're favored in every single game because you have the good fortune of hosting all of the most difficult games that you play. Baltimore, Kansas City, Philadelphia, and Cincinnati. Those are the toughest opponents you play. You play all of them at home. You're very fortunate the way that this schedule has fallen. It doesn't fall this way every single year. You've got to take advantage of it every single week by not letting any of these games look ahead or late game variants slip through the cracks, and you got to notch those wins.
Warren, I believe I've seen you tweet how you think the proposal to change the playoff seeding, or whatever it's actually technically should be called, will pass. I've seen today odds against it. I wonder if maybe you still have that position on it. And how do you feel about it? I get the logic behind, you know, dropping down a four seed, a weak division winner by record, but I also don't need it. I kind of like how it is now, and those games are interesting to try to analyze, where you have 11-6 at 9-8 or something like that. What do you see happening, and what should happen?
Yeah, I have changed my position a little bit based on some of the things that I've been hearing out of the teams that are in those AFC South divisions, where they generally are going to sit at the fourth seed. But what I was sort of basing my opinion on is the way that the NFL has been doing their schedule. It's crystal clear that their number one priority is bringing in more revenue. They want to sell those standalone games on pay-per-view scale. They want to be able to sell media packages in the future. And they're trying to break every record possible. And they want Week 18 to be must-see TV. They want their conference championship games to pit the two best teams if possible. And the way to most ensure that is to utilize the tactics in this new proposal to make those Week 18 games matter more. There was a slide that was showed at the league meeting, which went through the Houston Texans and the Los Angeles Rams specifically, mm-hmm. how they were sort of locked into their positions last year, so they rested their starters and they lost those games. But if the way that they want to propose had been used last year, the Houston Texans, instead of being locked into the fourth seed, could have fallen all the way to the seventh seed or been fifth or sixth. And same thing with the Los Angeles Rams, who knew that they were either going to be third or fourth seed, and now they could have been sixth or seventh seed as well. So I think Roger Goodell, the reason I felt strongly is because of Roger Goodell. I now believe that they may not get enough emphasis on it this year to get over the hurdle, but I think that you come back next year and it probably will happen, because generally speaking, Roger will convince these owners that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The league itself is going to benefit by making more money here, and that in turn will trickle down to benefit the owners. And it's not as if that fourth seed, like you just mentioned, like an AFC South team with a terrible record, it's not as if they're not going to make the playoffs. They're going to be in the playoffs. It's also not as if they're going to stop trying to play and win games, because the more games they win, the better the record's going to be. So there's still going to be a ton of these teams that are going to be competing all 17 games of the season. This is just going to further emphasize that you got to keep competing. You may not want to rest your players in Week 18.
Yeah, boy, so much of this conversation, Warren, has been predicated on rest and the value of it, right? The rest advantage or disadvantage, like you highlighted with the Lions and the Raiders, respectively. This is another way to take potential rest away, even for, you know, if a team's got the one seed all sewn up, obviously they can coast. But everyone else, you know, the Bills have, you know, this past year they were able to rest in Week 18. This potentially takes that away, and I don't know, man. Something about the league, adding games, so, you know, 17 games, we're gonna get to 18. Let's take rest away, potentially. I mean, everyone wins here, I think, except the players.
I agree, and I think that the players' union, in fact, would be the ones that would be the strongest opponents of something like this, because their players will be forced to play in some of these games where they otherwise might have, quote-unquote, earned a little bit of opportunity to rest.
Yeah.
So the league itself, from a revenue perspective, that's what's making this money. And from a fan watching the games, I do find it more interesting week 18 if more teams are playing for something as opposed to just sitting there watching a bunch of backups out on the field. So I understand that perspective as well, the league and the fans' perspective. From the players, though, absolutely, you want that opportunity to walk into the fact that you don't have to play one of your games.
Warren, thank you. Before you go, do you want to plug the book coming out, the website, anything having to do with Lord Reeves, Rich Rebar?
As well? Oh, yeah, he is outstanding. I'll tell you this. I'll do something. If you go to sharp.football and enter the code WGR for the book, instead of $35, it'll drop it to $1. I'll do a special discount here. So anybody who's interested, it's 500-plus pages previewing the upcoming season. You can get it for just $1. It'll come out in early July. That's when it publishes. You could pre-order it now if you use the code WGR.
Wow, Warren, great job. Thank you for that.
What a gift. Thank you. That's really, really generous of you.
On my way. Thanks for your time, as always, Warren.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Warren Sharp, sharp.football/WGR, he said. Let's see, it's $35. This now this way, it's $1. It's a savings of, carry the two, $34. That's a great, that's like 90% off almost, or more.
What can you even get for a buck anymore? A buck.
Not a lot.
Is a toll even a buck? I don't even know.
I think the Grand Island Bridge is $1.
Yeah.
Unless you live on the island, then it's like 8 cents.
Yeah.
Maybe a few more cents than that. It's better. It's a better deal if you live on the island.
Good. Well, that should be the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
With more of Sabres Live, presented by Seneca Resorts and Casinos. Nothing else comes close.
Looks like, sounds like Darren Dreger, hockey insider from TSN, has joined us here. I think you're in your normal time slot. We just had Shannon Goldman a day early because, Dregs, we're taking an extended long weekend. So welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Ah, my pleasure. You know what? You guys deserve it. You deserve that extended long weekend. You two guys work harder. Jeff, you guys just grind it out every single day of the week.
Okay. I'm thoroughly embarrassed, and I hate the fact that lies have just been spewed on this show. So I don't know what to do. Marty, take it from here.
No, I'm just going to say, so we were talking about lookalikes because somebody in a cab in L.A. told Duffer that he looks like Bruce Willis. So we asked Shana Goldman what our celebrity lookalike would be, and off the air, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to ask AI. So I asked AI, like, Shana Goldman's celebrity look. Like, it said Jennifer Lawrence. So I'm like, okay. So then I asked AI about you.
George Clooney?
I say George Clooney. It says, when it comes to celebrity lookalikes, Darren Dreger has been noted for his resemblance to former Toronto Maple Leaf center Tyler Bozak. So you go.
Yeah, I used to get that Bozak all the time. All amazing. The time. And Bozak used to say it as well. I'd go into the dressing room and he'd reference me as his uncle or older brother or something like that. And I did the same thing with Dean Lombardi when he was GM of the LA Kings, because people would say, what are you guys, like, separated at birth? And I'm like, what are you saying? He's like 15, 20 years older than me. Stop it.
Yes. Yeah, so I can see, okay, Tyler Bozak and Dean Lombardi, we'll mash them together. We'll do a mashup. Jeff is going to do some Photoshop, and we'll put that on the social. So that'll be great.
Awesome.
Hey, I don't know who a celebrity lookalike would be for Bo Byram.
Yeah.
But it seems like everybody's trying to match Bo Byram with any trade potential moving forward here with the Buffalo Sabres. So what do you think is going on with the Sabres, Kevin Adams, and Bo Byram, who needs a new contract, but seems like there's a lot of trade chatter.
a lot of trade chatter, and you can appreciate why, right? You know, anytime you've got a player like that who has been absolutely ground through the rumor mill over the last couple of years, managers are going to stay on that file. And, you know, we know that Bo is a restricted free agent. The preference from the Buffalo Sabres would be to get him extended. The problem is, and as we know, there's been a player agent change here, right? So Darren Ferris now represents Bo Byram. That's not necessarily a problem, but I would guess that Ferris looks at how far Byram is away from being an unrestricted free agent, is like, all right, Buffalo, if you want to talk extension, let's talk about a 1 or maybe a 2-year deal that walks him right to free agency, unrestricted. And, you know, why would Buffalo want to do that? You know, then he just absolutely walks for free. And I don't think that they're comfortable with doing that. In fact, I know they're not. Then you've got the flip side of that, which is arbitration. Bo Byram, you know, can elect for player arbitration. And just in dabbling around this file earlier today, it seems like he's going to come in around the mid sixes in an arbitration case. That's likely where he'd come in. So all of those factors come into play. They absolutely come into play. I expect that Darren Ferris will meet with Kevin Adams just before the combine or during the NHL combine, which is right around the corner, and then get a true lay of the land, share ideas and scenarios which could unfold, and then you go forward from there. The other part of it too here, fellas, is, you know, if you're Bo Byram and you're looking up at Owen Power or Darlene, you know, are you sitting there going, yeah, you know what? It's not the perfect scenario for me to continue to try and develop my skill set as a top pairing defenseman in the National Hockey League. So I think that all of that is being considered, along with a significant level of interest in Bo Byram on the trade front. But everything I've just said, the concern over the length of his contract is equally of a concern to the team that's going to try and acquire him via trade, unless you get the extension as part of it, a longer term, to give up the assets that Buffalo is going to demand in exchange for Bo Byram.
Darren, what do you think of Bo as a player? And then what do you think of him in the context of the Sabres as they're currently constructed? They were one of the highest scoring defense corps in the league last year. They had three in the top 35 in defense scoring, including Byram and obviously Power and Darlene at the top of that list. How do you view Bo?
I view him pretty much where he is. I think he's obviously a top four defenseman all day long. Is he a top pairing guy? I think he could be. I think he could be on a lot of NHL clubs. And that's not to say that he can't be that in Buffalo. You know, first of all, you need to see how it all plays out. But I think that there's more growth coming there. I do. And he probably looks at it and says, yeah, well, growth comes with opportunity, which, again, you know, amplifies what I said a minute ago and you're alluding to here with the strength that they have on defense with Darlene and Owen Power. But I know he's widely regarded. There's the pedigree there of where he was drafted and all of that. But teams with trade interest can see what he is right now as a legit top three NHL defenseman. And their interest elevates and their willingness elevates to give up a healthy return based on how they position him on their blue line,
right,
potentially as a top pairing guy. And if he's a top pairing guy there with opportunity, then you don't mind paying the price.
Is he gained value in Buffalo? Because, I mean, when they traded him for Casey Mittelstadt, and now they probably could get more than what they traded him for. So I feel like he's gained value.
I think so. Yeah. You know, I mean, fair or unfair, you know, he had a bit of the injury knock against him. You know, missed a good chunk of time with Colorado, but he's played through that. And now I don't think that that's in the back of anyone's mind. Different opportunity, obviously a different conference, all of that. But I think that he has elevated. I do. I, you know, when you watch the Colorado Avalanche play, and we're going back a few years here, but when you watch with Bo Byram in that lineup, you know, he was still very noticeable. He was still very effective. But I mean, pretty obviously, you're also looking at some of the other D that they have. They're starting with Cale Makar, and you're like, holy smokes, you know, look at that defensive core. But I would definitely argue that he has, at the worst, he's kept his level of play. It definitely has not gone backwards, and he's gone through some tough times in Buffalo.
Well, I think you guys are saying it exactly the right way. He's added value here. When June arrives, he will turn 24. Like, this is still an incredibly young,
early yet prime
experience.
Yeah,
exactly. And
yeah, early prime.
If you mention the way you did Colorado and Cale Makar,
yeah.
Okay. Well, what if a team, and maybe it's Buffalo, based on whatever else they're looking at? Like, if you believe that Byram is top pair, what if you're making him top pair with a reliable Devon Taves-esque player?
Agreed.
This is the whole thing that we talk about all the time here. And Kevin Adams has talked about it so much and trying to find the right match for Owen Power. Well, what is the right match for Bo Byram? Because, Marty, we saw a lot of him with Darlene this year. And in that window of time, a lot of people really liked what they were seeing.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. The problem is the business side takes over, right? Okay. And priority one from Kevin Adams' perspective is to sign Bo Byram to a longer term. And he probably sees exactly what you just described playing out. You know, and that's a part of his job as general manager to find, you know, the partner that makes the most sense. The problem is, you know, he's a restricted free agent. And, you know, if his intent is not to sign a long-term extension, then you've got to maximize the value in the asset and in return. And guys, you know this because you eat, sleep, and breathe this all year long in Buffalo. This team needs to turn the corner. They have to. They can't go through yet another year of all of it, right? So, you know, imagine where you're at after 1 year of an ARB case being settled. Or you buckle and you give him 2 years that walks him to free agency and then he leaves and you're like, okay, well, that was poorly managed. So I can appreciate why Adams has to do everything, including the significance of the trade offers that are sure to come his way. And I'm just, hey, look, I know that there have been trade offers in the past. It just never got to a place where Adams was willing to pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. Now I think he's at a place where, you know, maybe that meeting with Darren Ferris just before the NHL Combine puts him at a place where he knows the time is between now and the draft, or at least this offseason, to make that move.
Looks like Mitch Marner wants to go to free agency, or at least look on July 1 and get an idea of what's out there for him. I know it didn't go well in the playoffs, and it hasn't gone well in the playoffs for a while, but he's a 100-point player in the NHL, and the Sabres would love to add a guy like him.
Right.
So if you're Kevin Adams and you say you have to make the moves, do you kick the tires on Mitch Marner and throw $13 million at him and see what happens?
I think, you know, I would say that pretty much every team in the league, within reason, of course, is going to do that. Why wouldn't you? Of course.
Yeah, but Buffalo is like an hour and a half, 2 hours from Toronto. Mitch is a Toronto kid, just had his first kid. The family's close. Like, it could work in that way for Mitch Marner.
Right. Other than the fact that he has police posted outside his house because of the nonsense that has gone on in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, so is it going to get that much better if he signs in Buffalo or he signs in Detroit or maybe the Montreal Canadiens? Like, I mean, I get it. I understand that. I just feel like if Marner has made the decision that he's leaving, he's leaving. He's leaving. You know, he's going to a market where he believes he can win. Not saying that that isn't Buffalo in the not too distant future or Detroit, but look, given the masterful work of Bill Zito or Jimmy Neal with the Dallas Stars, it's hard to envision how you could make room, or Kelly McCrimmon and the Vegas Golden Knights. Mm-hmm. It's hard to envision how you could make cap space for a player of that magnitude, but I'm not writing those teams off. Yeah. Throw Tampa Bay into the mix as well. 100%. You can always create cap space by moving money. That's what these managers do now.
Yes.
So I think his options are going to be, they're going to be unlimited. And just quickly, like, you know, I would apply the same logic to Sam Bennett. right? Yeah. I mean, you know, he's going to be highly coveted. And for those who think, and, you know, not that long ago, I was one who thought that Brad Treliving, given his experience with Bennett in Calgary, man, he'd line up and he'd just say, Sam, here we go. Here's $8.5-9 million, whatever you need. I don't think Bennett wants to play in Toronto for the same reasons that Marner is experienced. And when you've got a plethora, I love that word, a plethora of options, why wouldn't you choose which one's best for hockey and your family?
It's your fault. The media is the reason why it's so negative in Toronto.
Yeah.
Dregs, Anaheim has to be very close to the top in all of this, right? Based on
LA, Anaheim.
Yeah, but Anaheim's cap space is huge, right? Yeah. And they truly need, I think, that to attach to their current young core. Agree?
Yeah, I agree. 100% agree. And man, maybe the Ducks don't get enough credit for that. It does feel like they're ready to make that move. What's curious about that, though, is you keep hearing rumors around certain guys. The Zegras rumors are never going to go away until he gets traded, and that could happen. That could happen as early as this offseason. I mean, you know, Joel Quenneville's going to have a lot to say in that sense. I've heard some McTavish rumors. Those are more old, and I think that's more wishful thinking of the teams that are hoping to pick Pat Verbeek's pocket and steal a young player like that. So that feels like a bit of a stretch. But I think Anaheim's ready to turn the corner. It looks that way. So, you know, why wouldn't they try and dive into that pool? And maybe there's a fit there for Marner, for Bennett. Go down the list.
Are you signing off, Marty?
Well, I was going to say if Toronto wanted to make a big, big splash, they could trade Austin Matthews, and maybe LA and Anaheim would be the teams where Matthews would want to go to, or Vegas.
You're not radioing me. I'm not taking the bait on this. Forget it. I don't know what you're trying to do. You want to trade Austin Matthews, Marty Baron? That's entirely up to you.
Know what? I'll be honest with you. I think Austin Matthews should have been rested this year so that he's much better in the playoffs. He wasn't 100%. He did say that. And he said he would be.
You don't think the Toronto Maple Leafs were on the side of him maybe not playing the Four Nations and enjoying the rest? At the end of the day, the player has to make that call. I mean, the team can say whatever they want. And I don't know that they specifically went to him and said, don't play at the Four Nations. But the rest probably would have done him some good. I agree with that.
We've run out of time.
We're not going to radio you. Sorry. My bad. My bad.
Dregs, we'll see you next week. Thanks so much.
All right, fellas. Enjoy your long weekend.